As you may have heard on the national news shows, NPR launched a series this week called A Nation Engaged. It starts with this query: what is America's place in the world? It's a question the next president will have to face, and its answer will be reflected in the U.S. role in global affairs, from fighting terrorism to trading with Asia. HPR is also participating in this project later this week on Town Square. And this morning, we begin with news analyst Neil Conan, who joins us most Tuesdays from his Macnut Farm on the Big Island. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Bracing for a little rain tomorrow, but everything else is good.
Okay, good. Aren't we all? There are so many directions that we could go with this topic. Let's try to narrow it down just a little bit and focus on the U.S. role in the Pacific. No one is ignoring places like, you know, China and Japan. Somehow the conversations, though, about the U.S. role in the world always seems to start in Europe and then go on to the Middle East. Why?
Yeah, it's so 20th century. To some degree, yes, obviously things in the Middle East are compelling. We fought two wars in Europe during the 20th century. But to some degree, it's because we're all brainwashed by Gregorius Mercator, the cartographer who first figured out how to make a flat map of the world. And he, of course, was European, Dane, I think. And he put, of course, the Atlantic Ocean in the middle, Europe on one side and the United States on the other side. And inevitably, it leaves Hawaii hanging off the edge of the world in the middle of nowhere. In the 21st century, we've begun to realize that Hawaii is, in fact, in the middle of the most dynamic region in the world that includes the world's three biggest economies. It is militarily challenging, and that's why we also hear about the pivot to Asia-Pacific that Barack Obama inaugurated, and that within a few years' time, 60%, for example, of the United States Navy is going to be based in the Pacific.
That's obviously, as you mentioned, all part of the military aspect. But the U.S. has the biggest economy in the world that you also mentioned. China's 2, Japan is 3. To hear it talked about in some circles, you know, it would seem that, you know, business and trade are the biggest parts of the U.S. role in the Pacific. Is that true?
You know, they go hand in hand. You know, the Pacific has been an American lake since 1945. Under the watchful eye of the Seventh Fleet, there has been 70 years of peace. I'm not skipping over the wars in Korea and Vietnam, which obviously did not turn out the way the United States would have liked. But even those wars did not challenge U.S. dominance in the Pacific. There has been no hint of interstate wars in the Pacific, and the peace engendered incredible prosperity. Japan rose from its ashes. South Korea and Taiwan overcame dictatorships to become vibrant democracies and modern economies. Australia and New Zealand are sort of in a class by themselves. Another economic miracle in Singapore.
And what about China?
I don't think any country profited more from U.S. hegemony than China. American power meant that it faced no external threat from the Soviet Union when it was weak and afflicted by Chairman Mao. American prosperity provided a market when China made the shift to export-driven capitalism like Japan and Taiwan and South Korea had done before it. China has, its accomplishment is incredible. It's lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty in the past 30, 40 years. Yes, hundreds of millions yet to go, but China's transformation is in no small part a byproduct of American power.
That transformation that you just mentioned includes a modern military that seems able and sometimes even eager to challenge the U.S. In the Western Pacific, as we've seen in the not-too-recent past.
As we've seen. You know, this is what historians call the Thucydides trap. If you remember, the great Greek historian writing about the Peloponnesian War said that, you know, the status quo power cannot abide the rise of a new power. In his case, Athens was the maritime empire rising to threaten Sparta. The Peloponnesian War resulted. Athens was destroyed. Historians quibble that it's happened about 10 times since then, and it's resulted in war 7 times. The principal role of the United States in the Pacific is to manage its relationship with China, to make sure they don't fall into the Thucydides trap, to accept China as a great power, acknowledge its enormous accomplishments and its enormous pride in those accomplishments, without at the same time letting China bully its neighbors in the South China Sea.
That's not going to be easy, though. I mean, the South China Sea is one of the three flashpoints that I'd actually like you to talk about, something the next president is going to have to deal with. Earlier this summer, we talked about the International Court in The Hague rejecting China's claims in the area. Since then, it seems we've sort of been, you know, waiting for the next shoe to drop.
Yeah, China rejects the ruling. It did not participate in the hearing. But it has not, since that ruling, taken military steps to reinforce its claims, which a lot of people expected. Some worry that it's just been waiting for the G20 summit that comes up next week and didn't want to create a crisis until it's over. It's, of course, hosting that summit. But so far, China's reaction has been restrained. The U.S. says it will continue the freedom of navigation patrols the Chinese consider provocative, but maybe not this week, not this right minute. But while the South China Sea is a powder keg, remember, $5 trillion worth of shipping cross the South China Sea every year. I want to repeat that, $5 trillion. There's trillions more in oil and gas believed to be beneath the seabed. That's not proven yet, but we'll find out. So nobody wants a war.
Okay, let's move to the next flashpoint. The uninhabited islands in the East China Sea, administered by Japan, also claimed, though, by China.
The Senkakus to the Japan, the Diaoyu to China. The fact that nobody lives there eases this a little bit. There's not quite the element of national pride there is for China in the South China Sea, but there is historical grievance. These islands have become the, you know, sort of pressure point for China's deep anger with Japan over the invasion and the atrocities of the Second World War. Now, China can ratchet up tension with Japan there whenever it's angry about something else. The U.S., of course, becomes involved because of the Mutual Defense Treaty with Japan. It's a flashpoint, but I don't think it's as dangerous or as complicated as the South China Sea.
Okay, so let's move on to the conundrum of North Korea. It's already a threat to South Korea. Its missiles can reach Japan and Guam now, and experts say it might be able to target Hawaii or the U.S. mainland with nuclear-tipped missiles, quite possibly before the end of the next president's term in office.
And this is not going to be easy no matter what. The only way to approach Pyongyang is through Beijing. China is the only country that holds levers on North Korea's behavior. It's been reluctant to use them so far, but Kim Jong-un is not popular in Beijing. He's not been granted a meeting with Xi Jinping, for example. The real fear is that young Kim does not see nuclear weapons as bargaining chips to win concessions. He sees them as crucial war-fighting weapons in a plan to reunify Korea on his terms. He would use them to nuke South Korean ports, to stop U.S. reinforcements, to threaten U.S. cities on the West Coast, and hope the U.S. will not want to escalate. In effect, he would say, you want to save Seoul, I'll obliterate Seattle. Mm-hmm. Now, this is hugely dangerous, of course, and China will have to be persuaded to abandon one of its very few real allies.
Neil, we're running out of time, but I just want to ask you about what you said a second ago. Reunite Korea on his terms. South Korea is much richer and better armed than the North. That doesn't even count the U.S.
But they don't have nuclear weapons. Look, this whole scenario is crazy, but one prominent theory right now holds that the only way Kim sees to perpetuate North Korean state, to perpetuate his family's power, is to conquer the South, to remove it as an existential threat to his legitimacy. If that's what he's thinking, and I know nobody really knows, of course, but if that's what he's thinking, the U.S. role is to persuade Xi Jinping that there need to be fundamental changes in North Korea, that the alternatives are worse. Right now, though, this is not going well.
All right. For the moment, we're going to have to leave it there. We'll talk to you again next week.
Okay, Beth Ann.
Thanks, Neil. Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes here on Hawaii Public Radio. We'll continue the conversation on America's role in the world in a special edition of Town Square on Thursday, and segments on A Nation Engaged also continue all this week on All Things Considered and Morning Edition.